Hello and welcome to the podcast for episode 201, the first episode of season 2 of Outlander. I'm Ronald D. Moore, executive producer and developer of the Outlander television series. And today I'm joined by two very special guests, our post-production co-producers, Michael Halloran and Alicia Bissette. Hello, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
Obviously, we'll be talking a lot about post in this particular broadcast, but right off the top here, just in terms of story, fans of the book know that this is not how book two opens. Dragonfly and Amber actually opens in a very different way in 1968, as a matter of fact. And we decided early on in the process that we weren't going to open season two that way. I sort of felt that that was too big of a leap for the audience to take from the sailing away to France and then go all the way to the 1960s, and instead opted to go to the 1940s and sort of see Claire's journey after she came back through the stones at Cragna Dun. Now, originally, this sequence that you're looking at now with Claire at Cragna Dun, having just come from the 18th century back to the 20th, originally wrote this with an eye towards making it the tag of season one, where you would have gone from the sailing ship, that last shot of them sailing off towards France, and then fade out, and then fade back in with this sequence of Claire mysteriously waking up at Cragna Dun, coming back to the 20th century, and you'd be wondering what the hell happened, and oh my God, and then the idea was to make it sort of a cliffhanger for season one. Talked about it a lot internally, talked about it with the network, ultimately decided that the image of the sailing ship was such a lyrical, cinematic way to put a period at the end of the sentence of season one, as it were, that we opted to go with that, and so this whole Cragna Dun and Claire meeting the guy on the road, we switched to become the opening of season two. Now, this stuff was shot later, as I recall. I'm trying to remember when we shot. A lot of this stuff was shot at a sequence, usually, but was this stuff shot later in the...
We had locked the show, actually.
Yeah.
And we were waiting on the opening scene. It was the only thing we needed, but we got it significantly...
Yeah, I believe, because we started shooting in May, and then I believe this footage came in August. So a lot of our episodes throughout both, you know, season one and season two, schedule-wise, oftentimes we're working with pieces as we go.
Yeah, I remember that this episode was shot in what we affectionately called the super block of episodes at the beginning of season two, in that we normally shoot the show in blocks of two episodes, and this time out, for various scheduling reasons, we decided to shoot three at a time. There was another piece of Claire, as I recall, screaming and being upset after she came out of the stones.
Right, and she walked down the hill, and then there was a long walk to the road, and we had voiceover.
Oh, right.
Tons of voiceover.
A long voiceover.
And then we kept it in the show, and then we just cut it. It's during the cutting process.
It was more cinematic, we felt, in the end.
To drop the voiceover.
To have no voiceover.
And we're against the constraints of total running time. We have to keep under an hour.
Right. What's the actual running time we have to hit?
Stars is very kind to us, but usually it's around 59:35-ish.
Yeah, and then we're always trying to get right to the
to the very end. Yeah.
Yeah. There's their credits. I remember when we were doing a Battlestar together, occasionally we would cheat and try to speed up the show.
Yes, Varispeed.
Varispeed. Yeah. Which
get an extra 30 seconds out of the credits.
Is it that much? It's 30 seconds.
No, I think we got the credits down to 30 seconds. Oh. They're supposed to be 53 or something.
It's surprising when you Varispeed the show, and that just means you're literally running the film faster.
Yeah, and the problem is you have to watch out for the female actresses, or female actresses anyway, because their voices tend to go really high-pitched when you speed it up.
And sometimes things fall and you can catch it with your eye that they're moving at the wrong speed.
But most of the time,
credit sequence is a new version for the first time.
Oh, that's right, we changed the main title. We started to make the changes here, and then the title will continue to evolve as season two moves forward. This was shot, we call these the title card sequences, which is something we came up with in season one is now the bane of production, because we're always, oh, what about the title sequence?
And they have to be exactly 16 seconds and no, 16 and two-thirds seconds.
Yes, very precisely. Matt Roberts, I believe, shot that title.
That's my favorite one, I think.
Oh, yeah, Wee Roger. We love Wee Roger.
That shot of Frank, his feet walking out into the hospital, that would have been the opening to season two if we had kept the Cragnet Dunn sequence at the end of season one. That was my inspiration was, oh, we'll open on Frank's feet.
It has a very Coen Brothers feel to it.
It is somewhat Coen Brothers, isn't it?
Some dehydration and superficial cuts and bruises notwithstanding. She appears to be in good health, but emotional issues.
Now, coming up are two things. There's a song you're about to hear, and then there's also a look out the window. Both, one is a whole music thing that we had to go through, and one is a visual effects thing we had to go through. There's the song. And what's involved in clearing a song for TV? People think, oh, why don't you just use music in TV, and how complicated is it?
Right, well, it's very, first we have to choose the song and the time period to make sure it's accurate. So we try to make sure that this song is pre-1948. It would be something that was played in the UK or Scotland. And then what I do is we contact Sony Music, which helps us give us a smaller selection that we know can clear. And then it's all about cost.
It's very helpful when Alicia gets the cleared songs up front, so we don't throw in Rolling Stones and the
right.
Beatles.
Yeah.
And
because they want lots of money.
Yes.
Exactly.
And people tend to fall in love with it. And,
then I have to be the bearer of bad news.
Now, this shot, the shot looking out the window is a visual effects shot. There's actually just a big green screen outside of Claire's window. All of this is.
And that is Kulon.
There's Kulon.
Ron and Terry's dog.
There he is. Literally dragging somebody down
yes.
the road. Setting up a VFX shot like this is kind of more complicated than you would think, because it involves a lot of people's eye lines and who's standing where and what, you know, how. I remember as Richard, our visual effects producer, sent the preliminary shots back, there was a lot of discussion about how far away the building
right,
across the street, the perspective.
Is she on the first floor? Is she on the second floor? We went with the first floor because of the whole, you know, street sounds. Also, if you saw the before and afters of this, there's actually, I think, four different layers. The people, the buildings.
Oh, right, they're all different layers.
They're all different layers. Kulon's a different layer.
Kulon's a different layer.
Maintaining Frank's reflection in the window is another layer.
It's a lot of work for seconds of screen time. It
right.
really is. But I thought it was really important that we firmly root Claire in the 20th century in this opening sequence. So I wanted her to be sort of overwhelmed by the music, the sounds from the street, the urban population, the buses, the whole thing, to sort of be shocking her back.
She definitely has culture shock.
She definitely has culture shock.
Come with Reverend Wakefield. He's prepared some rooms for us while you convalesce.
Yeah, speaking of post problems, this is a sequence we had a lot of trouble because Katrina's arm was in that position in some of the shots, but it wasn't in other shots, so we had to digitally fix that.
Oh, did you
yeah.
fix it?
You can't tell. But
wasn't there also some question about the later when we see her photograph, what position she was
right.
in the bed to have the photograph in?
Right, the photograph wasn't exactly what she was doing in the bed, so we had to manipulate the photograph then. Freaked out he is.
Yeah. I was always a little worried. It's like I love this beat with the clothes, with her clothes, but I was always a little worried that it didn't quite read on camera. That, like, did you know what that is? Did you understand what that, you know, that folded fabric
right.
was sitting over there? Did you get it? And sort of just have to go with it that the audience is smart enough to keep following along.
Yeah, it's interesting because when you're cutting it, it all makes sense. You know,
yeah.
I'm seeing the dailies and I see, you know, a 3-minute shot of that set of clothes, so.
Right, and they're there again as well.
Yeah.
This used to open with a shot of little Roger running around the yard with his toy airplane, as I recall. But I felt that starting on Roger and being outside in the garden was sort of starting the sequence on the wrong foot, because I still wanted to be with Frank. You know, you followed Frank in from the hallway into the doctor. You've gone into the room with him. You're still with. I wanted to still be with him and the Reverend at this point in the story, and wait, and then go outside to the garden. And starting with Roger running around with the airplane, sort of put you emotionally outside the house.
It was kind of a pleasant tone also.
Yeah, it was very lyrical.
Yeah, and I'm very much Team Frank, so I love the part where he snaps her clothes. Are you I find Team that Frank? So touching.
I love Team Frank.
I haven't taken sides yet.
Yeah,
I'm Team Claire.
I was very happy to have the Reverend and
love the Reverend.
Reverend back and Mrs. Graham.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, both of them are just great actors.
When I first draft of this scene, when I wrote it, I actually had Frank even less involved. He was, instead of the clothes, he was going to be sitting there poring over a folio of the Iliad, I think, and was really immersed in it, and Reverend Wakefield was the one talking about Claire, and why won't she talk, and you know, how long is it going to be, and Frank was trying to just sort of immerse himself and study and give Claire all the time that he wanted, and it was also basically because I was reading a book called Why Homer Matters at the time, and I was...
How indulgent of you.
Oh, I did it all the time. It's like, whatever book I'm reading usually finds its way into my right? sentence in some, because I'm like, oh, now I'm fascinated with the Civil War.
Good thing you weren't reading comic books
exactly.
at that time.
There would have been a Batman yeah. reference in there.
It would have been very un-Frank.
This fighter pass that's about to happen, I wanted this for a couple of reasons. The fighters in play in the sky, and then Mrs. Graham's little speech here about problems in West Berlin and Stalin. I wanted to not only remind the audience where we were in time, but also sort of emphasize that Claire has missed a lot of history, even in the 20th century. She was gone for a couple of years. When she left Scotland and the UK, it was in the immediate aftermath of World War II. Everyone was exhausted and tired and just couldn't believe that the catastrophe was over. But just a couple of years later, they're already talking about a potential new war with Russia, and it's just, I wanted to just emphasize the speed of change in the 20th century. I remember those airplanes going through a few passes as well, didn't they?
Yeah, but actually those were our wonderful visual effects producer Richard Briscoe did a lot of research ahead of time, so I think it was mostly just the movement that we had to nail down. The look of the planes pretty much only went through a couple passes though.
Sound went through several passes.
Yes.
Did the sound go through passes?
Yeah. Well, you wanted that exact accurate sound, so.
Yeah, we try to be very very historically accurate.
Yes, we're precise.
It's hard to really convey how different the sound is in the editing bay and what it is in the final mix stage.
Totally.
Because you guys have, what kind of, do you have?
Well, we're just using the Avid. I mean, there are shows that have a full sound department in the next room, so mm-hmm. when they hand the rough cuts in, they are fully mixed. And, you know, there's shows that are a lot simpler sound-wise, that don't have a lot of music usually. But the nice thing that we can do in the rough cut that you can't get away with in the final mix is we can be a little overzealous with the sound, like to sell the point, because people know, oh, it's just temp, you know. Yeah. So it's a lot tougher for the sound guys than and our people are amazing. We've same people we've worked with since Battlestar, Anifex.
Yep, they do all Vince our sound editorial.
Is a wonderful sound designer.
Mm-hmm. Vince Bolinas.
Although we must be very spoiled by the period that we do these shows in. Because, 10, 15 years ago, how much sound would there have even been in temp cuts? And
We worked on Star Trek together.
Right.
When we showed the temp cuts to Rick Berman, the showrunner at the time, we didn't have any music or sound in the temp.
Is there no music?
No. It was no music whatsoever. And towards the end, we started putting in the sound, but it was just so time-consuming. Mm. And now we can, you know, throw it in there fairly quickly just to sell the idea. It's my favorite part, actually, is doing the sound. I love doing the sound and the music.
Yeah.
I love doing the music.
You don't find that the technical aspect of that part is just so tedious to, like, sync up the
No,
the
you know what it is? You get quick at it. You yeah. really do. And
well, Mikey gets quick. I'd like to note, he's a rare individual, this one.
But the greatest thrill of doing the music is in that rare occasion when Bear, our wonderful composer, will send me a little note saying, oh, I was slightly inspired by the temp. But even that, coming from Bear.
That's
right, oh, yeah. No.
It was almost acceptable.
Right. Yeah. But, yeah.
Yeah.
Bear brings the show to a whole nother level.
Well, this is obviously sort of, to me, this sequence coming up here is really the heart of the show. You know, when Claire decides to tell Frank the story, and then Frank's reaction to the story, and his subsequent breakdown, and his embrace of her even after all that. To me, that's what this episode was all about. And that's, and it was the thing I looked forward to the most when we were breaking it, and it was the thing I enjoyed the most when I was writing it. There was some, we joke about Team Frank and Team Jamie a lot, you know, and some of the fans get really upset about it, which makes me, I think, is even funnier. But I've always liked Frank, and I've always sort of had an affinity for the character, and I wanted to play him trying to live up to the mission statement that he gave in episode 101. In 101 last year, he has a scene, you know, in a setting much like this where, you know, he starts to talk about whether Claire might or might not have had an affair during the Second World War, and she gets upset, and he says, look, I'm just trying to say if you had an affair, I would forgive you for it, and that I would love you no matter what, and, you know, forever, and, you know, my love to you is eternal. And that's a pretty big thing for people to say, and usually people say those things, they don't really mean them. And I kind of like the idea that Frank really meant it, and now this was going to put that to the test. Here, she's been gone for 2 years, she comes back, and he's trying to say, look, I don't care where you've been, it doesn't really matter, we're going to just go on. I promised, you know, I would. She knows she's got quite a tale to tell, and she's got some big news that she must tell him about the pregnancy. But he's going to try to live up to that promise no matter what. And that even after she tells him this long story, literally all night, it's like an amazing story, it's a crazy story, but he's, in that moment, I think he digs deep down and he goes, I'm still going to try to stand by that word. I'm still going to say I love you. I'm still going to be there no matter what, because he wants to be that guy. It's like Frank wants to be that man that he said he was. And then she says, but I'm pregnant by another man, and it, even that blows it up for Frank. Like, Frank can't go to that place yet. And so he has this big emotional reaction and, you know, trashes all the stuff in the shed and then comes back and still is willing to have her, but now on his terms instead of her. So I just really like that. I like that it was a really interesting place to take the character. I thought it was implicit in the books. I mean, this scene, these are scenes that were not literally in the books, but to me they were sort of implied by the storyline, in that as you read the books and you read the story of Frank and Claire, a lot of it's told in flashback or, you know, just from her reminiscing about things that were actually not played explicitly in the books. You kind of got a sense that Frank must have been like this on some level. Later he has his issues and their marriage has issues and all that, and we'll play that, and I won't get into it right now. But I kind of felt like any guy that's willing to take her back after being gone for 2 years and she's pregnant and agrees to raise that child as his own has some kind of extraordinary moral courage, or at least some kind of like intent about, you know, how much he loves this woman and how much he wants to live up to a certain idea of who he is as a man. And so I was fascinated with Frank, and this was a great opportunity to really go for it, and I just had tremendous faith that Tobias was gonna carry it off.
I have to say, I had never met Tobias, and I was over.
Oh, really?
I came to Scotland to cut this episode, if you remember. And Tobias had, this was one of the last scenes he did, and then he rapped. And David Brown, our amazing producer, brought Tobias down and just kind of knocked on the door. I wasn't expecting them. And they said before Tobias takes off, is there any way you can show him what you've cut together of this scene? And I have to say, he was just the most humble. Just one of he was, do you think I got it? And I'm like, oh my God, you're gonna, this is an Emmy nomination guaranteed right here. I mean, it's just one of the most, I think, in the series, the best performances of any scene, the two of them.
Yeah, it's great. It's
was great to sit there with him, though, and watch I stared at his reaction out of the corner of my eye the entire time. And, you know, I could say he was just like any real artist. He was, you know, nervous, and it was just really just... wonderful guy.
And isn't in this scene, because you, I mean, he does such a great performance. I think there's literally a 50-second take we stay on him while he's explaining to Claire his decision.
It's right after this in the scene with the reverend.
Yeah, where he just hold it, and it's
I think
so
that was
good.
A record for us, you're
right. Yeah, it was a record, but it's so good.
Oh, you couldn't cut.
Oh, yeah, that was with the red curtain.
Right. It's coming up right after. Oh, yeah, so you'll have to tell about the red curtain when we get there.
Oh, yeah, that's right, the curtain.
One of the more difficult VFX in the entire show, and you would never know at all.
I hope you have no idea.
And this is a tough scene, I have to say, for Katrina as well, because she has to hold back and not respond to this
right.
man. And
the restraint is amazing.
It's amazing restraint, and she's not asking the audience to be sympathetic. She's not like begging the audience to, feel bad for me because I'm trapped in a difficult place too. She's really holding firm to like, I've got to tell him these things, and I'm trying to send him away.
I have to say, editing this scene, it was one of the few times where the two actors were so powerful. You wanted to not cut away ever from either one of them. So it was a real, I have to say, I probably recut this more than any scene I've ever recut.
Really? This scene?
And it was easy to cut. I mean, both performances were perfect. Even the technical stuff, the matching worked beautifully. It was just, you know, it's a long scene. It's like six, seven minutes almost.
Yeah.
So, you know, just deciding which line to be on. The reactions from Katrina were perfect for the entire thing, and his performance during this entire speech here was perfect. So it was very.
Like, can you split screen? It was,
exactly.
Both the whole
it was
time.
So difficult.
Leaving him broke your heart. I can accept him.
Yes, even we're watching again.
No, it sucks you in.
We can hardly hear back here. It's like.
Just love him as he walks into this buzzsaw.
It's almost one consistent take the entire time. Yeah. I mean, that's the other great thing. I could cut
it does
anywhere.
Feel like the same take.
I think we only did, Metten, the director, only did two takes of this, and
really?
Both are perfect. So it was great. I could cut any time I wanted to. That's the reaction.
Yeah.
For a second, he's.
I love the idea that for a second he's right. happy and excited, and it just takes a minute to, like, wait a minute.
Right.
How could that be?
And you just see that 1-2 second shot in his eyes.
Yeah.
Perfectly comes clear to the audience and to him. It's just.
Coming down. I always like this exchange
because
it's like you can tell she sees Randall right
now,
and she's not backing down,
right?
And I love that. And then he sees that and he's like, who is this woman?
Yeah,
I love that. That's one of my favorite exchanges between the two of them.
I think in some ways she wants him to hit her because that would make the decision so much easier, because then she could just walk away.
And then, of course, now she's
I love how she grabs her stomach, the baby, you know, she's holding her stomach there.
This beat of Frank going out and going into the tool shed and smashing everything came, it was a suggestion from Ira Bear, in that my first pass at it, the scene was with Claire and Frank was pretty much the same, and he left, but Ira said, you know, I think you need something else. He's just had this enormous revelation.
Oh, so this wasn't in the original?
This wasn't in the first
draft.
He said, I think you just need to see something bigger. You need to see some expression of anger. He's too much of a mensch, I would say. He's too much of a mensch. He's already a mensch. We already love him, but there's a humanity that you got to play, and what's this guy's real reaction, and see the rage and see the frustration. I thought, that's a good note, and then came up with this way of just going out and smashing things in the tool shed.
I love how it slowly goes into slow motion and we lose the sound.
Yeah, I like all that. How many takes of this were there?
Two.
It's two?
Two.
Yeah, they couldn't build the shed over again that many times.
Yeah, I think that's the limit.
The prop people were...
they're like, we're out of boxes and we're not
I love him putting his hand on his
face. The best. The Reverend has a very nice home.
Yes, he does. this scene is day one. That, in fact, that might be day one's first shot. Might be that.
Mikey and I were standing outside. Yes.
Were you?
We had one of the rare times we get to actually come to set, so we were very excited.
It's such a treat to have you guys.
Yes.
We had fun.
This house is so out there because this is also the bed and breakfast. This is like this kind of crazy house, and the landlords or the people that own it, not the landlords, are very kind to us and let us use it over and over again. But you just want to wander through this house and keep opening doors because there's just all this stuff, like, everywhere.
Well, and it's so picturesque even outside. It's got there's lambs.
So what is it ordinarily? Is nothing? I mean, is it not a...
It's owned by just a private
family. They live there?
They live there. Oh, they live up in some of the upper floors. And the exterior of the house is not the interior of the house, obviously. Not obviously.
Gotcha.
People at home, the exterior of the Reverend's Wakefield's house is actually a completely different city from the interior.
Ah. So
this interior is part of a very large house with multiple floors, and every time you turn a corner, there's some new and intriguing bunch of stuff that you're just going to go, oh my God, what's this? This is from the Boer War.
I remember the house wasn't that big. Like, if what you're not seeing on camera, I remember, you've got like 50 crew in there.
I was
like
shocked,
sandwiched.
Too. Right.
Like, I remember when we tried walking
in, we felt
in,
really
like,
in the way.
Like, every little nook and cranny had a crew member.
But it rambles on and on and on.
Oh, this is what you were talking about, Alicia.
Oh, this is the shot. Yes,
this
here
tape.
It comes. So, obviously we play our great DP. Plays a lot with light. And so that red curtain back there actually isn't there. That's a visual effect. It is there. We just couldn't see it because it just didn't show up on film. And Frank kind of felt like he was in this black hole for a little while.
And it's kind of amazing. I mean, it's a very complicated effect, actually, because there's some other background there that wasn't coming in. There was something wrong with the actual piece of film, so you had to replace it. And
it was just nothing.
You can't tell that.
Yeah.
I mean, that looks completely real. There's no mask. There's this, I mean, job well done.
Well, and then it turns, and you see the Reverend soon. So there's a rack focus. There's
right.
all kinds
it was
of
difficult.
Things in there. It's one of those. We have lots of those kind of hidden visual effects throughout our shows.
And like I said, this is such a great performance. We wanted to hold this take. You just hold on Frank. But when you didn't see the curtain and when literally that was just black, it felt like we had gone to a theater all of a sudden.
Yes, we were doing something stylistic.
It was very stylistic, and it felt like it kind of took you out of the show.
Yeah.
That's the one thing. I mean, Alicia has to spend an incredible amount of time on visual effects that no one would ever know were visual effects. There's because of the modernization pass she needs to do.
Well, yeah, the
explain
fact that.
It's very interesting.
Well, the fact that most of, I would say, a lot of our visual effects shots, I hope anyway, nobody ever notices. It's to make us back into, take us back in time into the, you know, 1700s, the early 1900s. And make sure you see no antennas, no, sometimes, you know, even sound. You've got to watch out for if there's a plane.
Signs, road signs.
Gutters.
Gutters.
We researched a lot of gutters.
Talk about ear holes.
I don't know if we should.
Well, maybe I'll save that for the next podcast.
Next podcast.
Yeah, certain actors and actresses have earring holes that should not be there in the 18th century.
Yes.
And we have to occasionally try to cover them up.
Yes.
But yeah, so we have a lot of research. I mean, even I remember season one, I learned that in Scotland they didn't have white window paint. So we had to make sure that we removed that in the obvious shots. I mean, it will probably
And you'll get notes from Gary, our set designer. Mm-hmm. Production designer all the time about, well, let's not see that particular window on this particular building.
Oh, really?
And you're just like, okay.
But yeah, it's I hope that no one notices those visual effects.
Oh, I forgot to mention we're drinking vodka today instead of the usual Scotch whiskey. in honor of Mikey, who's a vodka drinker.
This is, I do appreciate that guy.
This is square one is the...
Organic.
Organic.
And the smoking lamp is off.
The smoking lamp is unfortunately off.
Do you still talk about the smoking lamp?
It's like, it's so rare that I get to light it. It's like, I have to do the podcast in some place where my wife isn't around, and I won't get busted in some office environment. So the smoking lamp is unfortunately out.
What I do miss most, though, is the cats. You should bring them by if you're going to do it here at the office, just to, you know, be consistent.
Well, I should shout out, though, we do have Rosie, the dog.
Oh,
Mikey's
Rosie's
dog, Rosie.
Here.
She's here.
Asleep and doesn't cause any problems, so you won't notice her.
I got in trouble once on a Battlestar podcast because I made some reference. The cats were driving me insane, and I said something about for a burlap sack in a river, and people got really upset.
You PETA after you.
Yeah, they were like, I can't believe this.
The Moors are animal lovers, just so everyone knows.
Yes, we're just saying that.
They even have chickens.
That's right.
By the way.
Okay, coming up is a big transition that. Originally in the story, it was a less interesting transition, frankly. I just sort of said that Frank and Claire were going to get in the car, drive away from the house, and the Reverend and Mrs. Graham were going to wave goodbye, and then we were going to transition from that to the ship arriving in Le Havre. Stars, Chris Albrecht, actually, the president of the network, kept saying to me, that's just really boring. He said, can't you come up with something more cinematic? There has to be a really great transitional shot there. And I was like, fuck, you know, like, really? So I kept, like, mulling it over and bitching about it, and eventually I was like, all right, what could be an interesting cinematic transition? And I started thinking about transportation. Okay, the car to the ship is not a great transition. Okay, what about maybe it's an ocean liner. So my first pass was, maybe it's an ocean liner. Let's look in, and I had David Brown, our line producer in Scotland, start looking into docks that we could shoot at and maybe do a green screen ocean liner sequence where Claire and Frank are going up the ramp onto an ocean liner, and then you would have Claire and Jamie coming down the ramp in the 18th century. And I kind of was tickled with that idea for a while, and then somewhere along the line I just thought that wasn't quite as big a leap as an airplane. Oh, an airplane. That's a bigger shift of technology, and then we could actually be in America and coming off the airplane in New York City, and that could be the transition. When she gets to the bottom, she reaches out her hand, and the hands will be the transition. So it was like, okay, Chris, yeah, you got your more cinematic transition, and it's actually a much better idea.
A good note.
It was a very good note. So now that sets us up for this very elaborate visual effects sequence that is just lots and lots of things to talk about how this was all accomplished.
I think it's the most elaborate we've done, right?
This is a pretty elaborate one. This was a lot of green screen work, a lot of 3D modeling, a lot of just hours and time spent going over and over these shots.
Yeah, and also extra visual effects shoots for the different elements, which we've actually kind of gotten better and better and better at throughout the season. It's now not quite as scary as it used to be.
Found our sea legs.
Yeah, exactly.
I just say, Katrina is an absolute pleasure to cut. Certain actors never misses her lines. Always gives you not a variety, but there's a range within the takes that you can, if you want to, like, change it and play it slightly less serious or more serious, or makes my job very easy.
I just appreciate that she knows exactly where she is.
Yeah.
She knows.
It's kind of amazing.
She always knows where she is in the story. She always knows what the intent of the scene
is. It kind of guides me when I'm cutting it.
Yeah.
She's even in our ADR sessions with voiceover, her first instincts are so spot on. And she'll literally go, what? Try one more time. And usually if she's right, then the next performance is what we choose.
How much ADR do we do in any individual episode?
Well, I have to say, and I'm not sure, our on-set sound recordist is amazing, Brian Milliken. He, my mixers, my sound suit.
Yeah, it's impressive.
Normally on any other show I've worked on, you're talking, Claire, for example, Kat would have maybe 30 lines of ADR. We have maybe 6.
Really?
I don't know if our actors are aware of how easy they have
like,
it.
Like, we have it. Well, and also I have to tip my hat to Vince, our sound editorial supervisor, and then our mixers, Nello and Al. They can do wonders as well. Yeah. So we make a lot of, because, you know, the Highlands are windy and intense in the sound.
And most of our stuff is exterior. I mean.
Yeah, we have a lot more exteriors than, you know, a lot of other shows.
Usually you loop all of that.
So, yeah, so I would say, you know, Cat, maybe six lines. I think...
That's incredible, actually.
Yeah.
That is pretty
Although cool. I will say, poor Sam has more only because we have those requests to Americanize his accent
sometimes. That's really tricky stuff. Cause
just to understand what they're saying.
And a lot of times we get so used to hearing them in the Scottish accent, and then other people in the network or the studio go, what? Yeah. What did he say?
Exactly.
That's weird. I can hear them now because I do it all day perfectly. There's no problems. But in the beginning, I was... But we put the ADR note on the screen, and I would write it constantly. Now I never do.
So yeah, and that goes for Colm and Dougal and Angus and Rupert. We sometimes have to ask them to just kind of lay low on the Scottish.
There's the blue coat again.
Love the blue coat.
Love the blue coat from season one.
And actually, I don't know if you wanted to talk about this, but the insert shot of the two rings as well, and the stone that was added later on.
Yeah, at the very beginning, way back at Cragg and Dunn, her discovering that she'd lost the ring and trying to find the ring and then realizing that the stone of the ring was gone was something we added much later in the process, well after the show was done, for various story reasons having to do with time travel that we realized we needed to establish. That you will discover later.
I really like the way Metten did this.
Yeah, I love this. Okay, there is no airplane.
No airplane. The window's real.
The window's real, and everything else is green. So there is no aircraft there. That's just a big green screen, just... sort of mocked up fuselage. The stairs are real, the people are real, everything else is CG.
Everything, the sky.
This took so much time and effort. They did an amazing job. I completely believe that's an aircraft. The people are real, the luggage is real, everything else is CG in these shots.
Yeah, everything's CG.
A lot of work to get the skyline right, to get the perspective right, to get the sense of distance. This is live. This whole little sequence was shot out back behind the sound stages near where the actor trailers are. Again, there's no aircraft back there, so all those reflections had to be put in. We had to age the fuselage.
It's a tiny little parking lot.
It's a tiny little parking lot.
And even there, in the hand, the sky is not real. We added the sky in that.
Yeah, because the sky just was blank. You couldn't tell that it was clouds. It just looked like a white background. And... oh, yeah.
That guy.
Oh, yeah.
That guy.
Oh, Outlander.
Team Jamie.
Right, it's not the Frank and Claire show. That's right. That is a lot of work in that shot. The ship is real, the ramp is real, and there's a dock and water there, but all the buildings on the side are all CG. This was shot, God, I don't remember the name of this place.
Yeah.
This is a location in Scotland.
The town was very excited, I remember.
Yes, I mean, the water out there is real, and we are at a dock, but it's a very sort of bare bones, mostly concrete dock. That wall back there is real. When you go to the other side and you're looking at the buildings and you're looking at the wide shots, all the buildings and structures are pretty much put in CG.
Hey. I love Martin.
Duncan's great.
There's not a sack of grain you're tossing about.
In the first draft, there was an extended walk and talk sequence here with Claire and Jamie that dealt with a lot of the issues that are now covered in the inn and later with Jared. Her talking him into pursuing the idea of changing or stopping the war as opposed to trying to win the war. I had a whole different take on it in the first draft. Was Claire made this long analogy about she had seen two world wars, really. The first war, she... went on this extended speech about World War One and how that had happened, and it happened. Everybody thought it was going to be over quick and easy, and then it ended up taking 4 years and costing millions of lives. And she was doing it to illustrate that once a war starts, there was no way to sort of predict how it was going to go. So that the best way to start it, to stop the disaster from befalling the Scots, was not to have the Jacobite Rebellion happen at all. It was one of those sort of writerly speeches that you fall in love with on the page, and as you're writing, you're like, oh, I love these words. They're flowing. It's so beautiful. And then people read it, and they go, you know what? This is just a long, stupid speech about World War One. What does this have to do with fucking anything? And I say, well, but it's a good speech.
It's fascinating.
But it's fascinating.
Good for another show.
Yeah, good for another show. And then you go, well, maybe it doesn't really work. So then it got cut, and this scene became a little bit more personal, because now it starts with Jamie's sort of shadow of Jack Randall, and reminding the audience, oh yeah, this is just a few days after the events from the end of last season, and he's still under, you know, he's still feeling the reverberations of all that in his character, and dealing with sort of their personal story before we get into the larger sort of political moves.
Didn't you say or tell me that the Abbey that happened in the last episode of season one was supposed to be in this episode? Originally,
in the book, the way the book is structured is that they leave Scotland and then go to this abbey in France, and that's where his recovery happens, and that's where she gets to the bottom of what really happened between Jamie and Jack Randall back in Wentworth Prison, and the whole healing process and discovery and revelations of all that actually happened in France. And when we were working on season one, I just felt that I wanted to keep them in Scotland and keep the jeopardy of their escape live, so that all the Abbey stuff just got moved back and put into Scotland, so that we could end season one with him leaving for France and getting on the ship.
Cleaner for television.
It was just cleaner, yeah.
I don't know the tactics. I don't know the strategy. I don't know where the armies were. Why didn't
This is on our sound stages, actually. This is now the first time we were back on our sound stages. In season two, as I recall, we started on location. We were doing the Frank and Claire stuff out at the Reverend Wakefield's house, which was on location, and then this was built on one of our sound stages. And I think this was finally the return to the Cumbernauld facility. Was this scene?
Yeah, and always good to note that they were also shooting episodes two and three simultaneously.
Yes, this was the super block.
Super block. Like, it's pretty impressive what the director and crew and everybody could do.
We can infiltrate the Jacobite movement.
A lot of discussion and tedious conversation about Jamie's bandaged hand and the brace that we eventually, you'll see later, that he develops to wear, and you know, how mangled was his hand going to be permanently, and well, what kind of a brace would it be, and well, are there bandages on it now? What kind of bandages? And when do the bandages come off? And when does he go to the brace? And how flexible is the brace? And just like on and on and on. You just, it's one of those things that seems so small, but somehow takes up an inordinate amount of your time.
Make some introductions.
It is funny when you see a memo that we're going to have a meeting about something specific, just about that. You know, and then eight people attend. And
yeah, so tomorrow's Jamie's hand brace meeting.
I feel for the makeup department too, though. I mean, Jamie, if you guys read a scene where he's got his shirt off, it's like every scar on the planet. I mean, his body is just covered in scars now.
It's like 2 hours, I think, or an hour and a half.
How much do you fix that
in the bag?
Well, I mean, you know, again, hats off to the makeup department, but, you know, our scenes, he is moving.
Right.
He is doing action scenes, so the makeup can only, you know, stay on.
And the lights.
And the lights, so, you know.
Cause the glue to run or something, right?
Well,
or,
you know, you're going to see edges.
Right.
So visual effects does smooth down any kind of edge work on the makeup, just to help him out a bit.
We'll see the back coming up
in
two more scenes.
Yeah, and basically, yeah, we're just trying to take down that it looks like any kind of plastic or that there's any edges, just to make it
smoothing
it out. But they, I mean, what you see is really what makeup's created, you know, they've created.
And they literally have a map of all his wounds.
Yeah.
Yep.
And they have a map of all the wounds on his body, which just keeps getting bigger and bigger.
I mean, yeah, we've got the, as I said, the bullet wound, the back, when he was stabbed.
What the hell are we
where he cut out the little seal.
From JR.
The growing list.
And for those that have read the books, so they know there's only more to come.
Yes, yeah. There's just four more.
I can't. I'm sorry.
You must trust this. I trust you with my life. You can that well. It seems to me you don't trust me to know the true reason behind this.
I do love that we go to locations so much.
It opens the show in a great way.
Yeah, it really does. It makes you feel like you're really there.
Yeah, it's like a movie.
To stop the Jacobite rising.
There's a lot of discussion in the writer's room about, you know, when and how they would tell Murtaugh the truth about what was really going on. I don't think that they really did in the book, but the way the show kind of developed, you sort of felt that these three characters form a bit of a trio in this whole adventure in Paris, and we just felt it was really awkward to keep trying to not have Murtaugh aware, and then at some point
Respect him too.
Yeah, they respect him, and the relationship that they had formed, in particularly between him and Claire in season one. You know, he's Jamie's godfather, but you know he really bonded with Claire in season one in particular. So now the three of them are on this journey together, and we just kind of felt that. We had to acknowledge this, that you know he was smart enough to know that they were keeping something from him, and eventually they would have to tell him. And it just felt like, okay, let's just address it here in the first episode, make the promise that eventually we're going to tell Murtaugh the truth.
When will be the proper time?
You tell me, Sassanac. Another one from the future.
Big visual effects shot again.
I admire your patriotism, to be sure. But I am curious as to your sudden change of heart.
And this is really Jared's only appearance in the show. Is this in this series? Really? Is these little scenes here at the end of 201? I don't think he comes back to us.
Mm-hmm. No, but actually, I would like to note that this is the first time we're seeing real Parisian wear.
Oh, that's true.
So this is the first time that we see something a little bit fancier.
Yep.
Silks. And I will say, this is where we're trying to transition to Paris, and we did a lot of extensive color correction with Ron and Terry on making sure that we did justice to the beautiful costumes coming up. And this one, I remember clearly, we had made sure that his coat reflected the exact color. That
because they look quite different in dailies when we get it. Sometimes a green coat will look gray or...
And he kind of has kind of like a pumpkin colored vest.
Yeah.
You know, so we just want to make sure that all those colors were shown. And as we see later on, it gets even fancier with Saint Germain.
That color is, I mean, it's remarkable how much time and effort is now spent just in the color correction process.
It makes such a huge difference.
And our color artist's name is
Stephen Porter. He is really great.
Very talented guy.
We can just give him kind of like a general idea, and he just runs with it and has his own thoughts and contributes many different ideas.
One of the great things about Steve also is he's a cinephile, and so when we do the looks, you know, different looks for the World War II era and for the 1940s and for this, he really brings a cinematic knowledge to what. You know, especially when you want to add grain and stuff like that make it look like a certain film stock. He, off the top of his head, he'll tell you, oh, that's Kodak 1953. And it's just like...
Exactly. And, I would say going back to the plane sequence, LaGuardia, that was actually his idea, was to go with that Technicolor look. Because all I had said was, I feel like this is Claire becoming, you know, starting a new life. I want to make it different from 1940s. And he said, okay, let me play with it. And he came back and he said, you know, I went Technicolor where, you know, when they started developing the Technicolor film process, the colors that would come out were more pronounced, were reds and greens. So that's why that is kind of more vibrant, cinematically. So it looks different.
It's amazing to sit in the bay and watch him work. Because I went to a couple of early sessions where we just discussed sort of conceptual things and went through some sequences. And to see him play around with color and how radically he can change it and how subtly he can change it.
And how into it he gets.
Yeah, he gets really into it.
He's passionate.
It's a fascinating process.
Well, just for example, in this scene, he can literally take that coat on Jared and affect just the coat and nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
If you want that coat to be more green or more blue or whatever, he can do that no problem.
Why should they meet?
He can bring details out of shadow or bury details in the shadow. It's just, it's remarkable.
Now come to France with a price on his head and not much more than the clothes on his back.
But I should say it also stems from our DP.
Yes.
Because if the information's not there and the design's not there, there's not much Steve can do. And that's Steve McNutt, by the way, our DP.
Yeah. Steve, who came to the show this season. I worked with Steve on Battlestar Galactica. He's an amazing Emmy-nominated cinematographer who I enjoyed working with very much. It was really fun to have Steve now join our family.
I've been delaying a trip to the West Indies until I could find someone competent and trustworthy enough to run the wine business in my absence.
There was a little piece here that was cut that will probably end up in the deleted scenes later on in the DVD that I'm sure you're all going to buy. That they do a toast to seal the deal. After, you know, they pour some whiskey, and there's a little ritual they do that's to honor the king over the water, which is the exiled king, King James.
Yeah, it's a nice little moment.
It's a real Jacobite tradition, but again, we were trying to get our runtime down, and something's got to go, and it was an easy cut to make. You're like, oh, well, if we cut the toast, then we're on time.
By the way, editing-wise, one of the great things about working on premium cable is not having to worry about that strict running time, commercial television. So we can be anywhere between,
It's 52 or 50 minutes and like 60 minutes.
Right, so you're just worried about making the show good instead of getting it to time.
Yeah, and when you're breaking them down into individual acts for commercial breaks. And
those false climaxes.
Oh,
and
so
where you have to have the intense music right before the
commercial.
This is a lot of VFX work. All that.
That's
almost
all fake.
I mean, the people down walking across there are real, and the water's real, but not much else. The sequence coming up is they go into the warehouse. I remember you had to re-edit this quite a bit.
Quite a bit.
Because I think one of the problems was, it was a script problem. I identified who everyone was in the script, like, oh, this is the captain, this is the port official, and this is this in Saint Germain. But I didn't actually, in dialogue, identify,
right.
So there were all these people running
coming
around.
Coming in and giving orders, and one
yeah.
seemed to be in charge of the other, and you didn't understand the hierarchy. And
so I had to rewrite it, which meant it was going to be like a lot of ADR and a lot of French ADR, and
right.
then you had to like completely like rejigger this whole thing.
The captain tried to stop me from seeing the sick crewman because he knew the truth.
Yes, so there's the moment where you identify the captain.
Oh, and it's actually pouring rain out that window.
In some of the takes, and the other half of the takes, it's not raining at all.
Yeah.
So we added the rain, right? Or
no,
do we take away the rain?
Remove the rain.
I would say half the shot.
There was discussion whether it would be cheaper to add or to remove.
It was hard.
Like in those shots, like looking out the window, the door there, sorry.
And pouring.
It was just pouring, and then in other takes it wasn't.
Yeah.
The comped. Again, thank you for casting.
Yeah, yes.
The women in the office seem to be very fond
of the
comped.
I know, comped has his fans. There's team comped.
Yes. They seem to really... And we cut some stuff out in the middle here, which made it a little difficult to reconfigure the geography.
A lot of the scene was drawn straight from the book, so we were sort of following along with how Diane had laid out, you know, the sequence of events. And then, once we started cutting and changing, then it became difficult to get you back
right.
on track.
Speaking of Diana, one of the great moments, the only time I've ever met her is when you brought her in to show her for the first time ever, episode one.
Oh, yeah.
And then you had to go back to the story break in the other building, and so it was just the two of us, she and I, watching for a good portion of it. And I remember asking her after it was done, I said, so is it anything like what you've had in your head for 20 years? And she said, in some ways it might be even a little better. So I was relieved.
Yeah, that was a big moment.
Yes. And she signed my book, and it was a great moment for me.
Trust me.
Now, this season, obviously, there's a lot of French in the show, and I think that has doubled up on you guys having to double-check lines and ADR lines. And
yeah, so our process there is in Scotland, or Scotland editorial staff, when they do the editor's cut and director's cut, they kind of do a pass with Guillaume, our translator, who just kind of checks the dailies, and we kind of locate or, you know, make sure that we know what they're saying. But then, of course, it goes through many different passes. So once we lock it, and some of us have a general idea.
And Meryl speaks very good French. So.
Yeah, so, you know, we have a general idea, but then once the episode is locked, we do send it back to the writers and to Guillaume and Meryl and go, did we get it right? And, you know, we're generally right, but then they
Meryl keeps us honest.
Meryl keeps us honest.
That's got to be hard to cut, like when you're putting the initial assembly together of the scenes when it's a language you don't speak,
well,
and you're just trying to cut the...
I'll be honest, when you're first cutting it, you're not really paying attention to exactly what they're saying, because
honestly,
I don't know what they're saying.
Yeah.
So I do it just dramatically by the, you know, the look on their face, and then that's when you, after that is when you have to start, like, you know, being honest ourselves about it.
I feel like you gave us good training wheels with the Gaelic from last season.
Yes,
I mean, I'm sorry, I don't know any what they're saying at all,
yeah.
But I remember sending it back to our Adam, and it just...
The big difference is, I think, what, 15,000 people speak Gaelic?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Quite a few more speak French.
We had a lot of conversations, both in the writer's room and with the studio network, about how much French we were going to play in the show this season. Because it's a fine line. You need it for the authenticity of it, but how often do you want to read subtitles in the show? It's become, American TV audiences have become more and more familiar with reading subtitles, but it's still kind of one of those things that you don't want the show to be completely a foreign film.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is actually stock footage, as I recall.
That my amazing post-supervisor, Michelle Mason, she found this.
I mean, it really looks like
we
shot it specifically it has the barrels of everything. I mean, it's amazing.
Basically, we thought this was going to all have to be either shot or visual effected, and so...
For a tenth of the price of shooting, probably.
Oh, even less.
Yeah.
This was found through Sony stock footage. So this is for some Sony movie somewhere. I honestly have no idea which one.
And then the wider shots are visual effect shots that Richard farmed out and produced. There was an intervening scene that we cut, because it really didn't give you anything. It was like Claire and Jamie getting into the carriage with Jared getting ready to go to Paris, and they were sort of recapping what had happened and saying, oh yeah, Saint Germain's a bad guy and you guys are in trouble, and then they went to the dock and kind of set it all over.
There was a light moment with Murtaugh fighting with the guy who was loading the carriage.
Little and this is all CG.
His eyes are glowing. I just noticed that. He's so evil.
He's so evil. Well, there you have it, 201. The beginning of season two. It's sort of two episodes in one, I've always thought. But a good start to the season overall. So thank you all for joining us. Thank you, Mikey, and thank you, Alicia,
for
having
me
on the podcast.
Thank you for
having
us.
And
exciting.
We will talk to you very soon in episode 202. So until then, I'm Ronald D. Moore, and good night and good luck.